Let's roll up our sleeves and learn about somebody interesting.
Okay,
Guys, we're back tonight, and we're here to talk about our latest in the series of profiles in the pandemic. It's actually interesting. Tonight's year is going to bring us full circle to back to that wonderful period in time where we talked about the incredible year 1831, which was such a shocking year for world Jewry and the world at large. There was a major cholera epidemic that broke out that year. About 10 weeks ago, we got together in shul right before we closed, and we sat down and we talked about Rabbi Akiva Eiger. And then we repeated that particular shiur the next week. It was one of the first shiurim that we had together over Zoom. And in that context, we learned a lot about Rabbi Akiva Eiger. And tonight we're going to look at his son-in-law, who probably, you know, when we think of a son-in-law, we think a generation down. But we're really going to discover that his son-in-law, Rabbi Moshe Schreiber, the Chasam Sofer, was really only a couple years younger than Rabbi Akiva Eiger. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, Rabbi Akiva Eiger outlived his son-in-law. But that's because of part of the interesting world that was the life and the times of the Chasam Sofer. So what I want to begin to do tonight is to turn around and give us a perspective into the life and the times of the Chasam Sofer, and in particular, how I believe some of these things shaped the way he approached that pandemic in 1831. And what's interesting to me is when you look for the approaches of Rabbi Akiva Eiger, you have to find it in disparate locations. When we did Rabbi Yisrael of Shklov, we had to put the pieces together from different places. There is a wealth upon a wealth upon a wealth of information about the Chasam Sofer. I refer you again, if you can see in the camera, you see my friend the Corona binder. This is my binder of all the different experiences that I've picked up through the study of Corona. And my friend in Israel, a great Jewish scholar, turned around and said to me, "Oh, you're into the Chasam Sofer? I want to show you something that came out in Israel." And just for the sake of taking a look, these are four pages to a page. There are 376 pages on the Chasam Sofer's understanding of pandemic called Mishnah Chasam Sofer. So there's the material itself, and then there are analyses and takeaways and thoughts that came out. Chasam Sofer was a pretty, pretty interesting, powerful person. And the big question is why? Why is there so much about the Chasam Sofer? What is it that makes him so significant and sort of funky, if I may? And why I believe he is probably one of the most misunderstood people. I had a particular approach to the way he existed and thought. And then in the course of studying a little bit, I realized he's not that far different hashkafically, but maybe not as intense in certain points in time. Let's begin at the beginning. His name, we call him the Chasam Sofer, but as Rabbi Dr. J.J. Schachter always taught us, his mother didn't call him Chasamol. Right? His name was Rabbi Moshe Schreiber, the Chasam Sofer. He was born in Germany, Frankfurt on Main, in 1762, during the Seven Years' War. His father was a Rav. His name was Rav Shmuel. And his mother's name was Reisel. His mother was also, no, his mother's mother was the daughter, his mother was the daughter of Rav Shmuel Shatten. Rav Shmuel Shatten is known to us as the Mahar Shach. The Marashach was a tremendous Talmud Chacham, he became the namesake, Marashach, was the namesake of Rav Moshe Schreiber, the Chasam Sofer. Keep that in mind, because we're going to come back to the Marashach and his influence on his grandson. His mother was known as the Tzadikis. Why is she known as the Tzadikis? So Dr. Henry Abramson from Turo turns around and tells the following story. He says, you know, his mother went into labor in the summertime. Right, this was before Rosh Hashanah. I'm sorry, before Yom Kippur. He was born on before Yom Kippur, and so the town in Frankfurt on Main, they used to take early Shabbos, and so she went into labor. She didn't want him to be born on Shabbos because if there was a chashash pikuach nefesh, she'd say, "Look, if we don't have to take Shabbos now as a town, right, then I won't have to ask people to go ahead and be so to speak mechalal Shabbos." For the sake of Pikuach Nefesh. Now, the truth is, Pikuach Nefesh is Docha Shabbos. It pushes off Shabbos. She says, but why do you need to take it early? So she sent a message into the shul to ask that that they wait. They wait to take Shabbos. Now, you know, Europe, sometimes at that point in the year, Shabbos comes in pretty, pretty late. Our friends in the community, there's a group of guys who've gone to Scotland on a number of occasions. And so that when they went to Scotland, they were telling me Shabbos comes in at 10:30 at night. So everyone takes early Shabbos. That's the way it is. You know what that means? It means Shabbos ends at 11:17. I think the last time I talked to the guys, they were telling me, yeah, Shabbos ends at 11:30. So what'd you do? So we went to sleep. We went to shul. We came home. We ate. We went to sleep. We got up. We ate. We went back to sleep again. We learned a little bit. We talked a little bit, whatever. We were able to walk around. And there were still 7 hours left to Shabbos. Right? So, you know, when things came, we had pushed and came to shove, Shabbos ended at 11:17 at night. So, you know, people took a lot of early Shabbos. So she asked them to hold out. And the Rav of the shul did hold out. And she had the baby right before the real Shabbos would have started. And so the Rav got so excited. He said, this young man is endowed with special qualities. You will call him Moshe. Because Moshe also had that special quality. We learned that in the Daf Yomi today. That Moshe Rabbeinu was granted certain special uniquenesses. He had certain experiences. And he became known as Moshe Schreiber, the subject of tonight's shiur. Now, it's interesting, Dr. Abramson also points out that for some reason, historians believe that for the first 3 years of this kid's life, he looked like Michael Jackson's son, Blanket. If you remember, Michael Jackson had a son, Blanket, who went outside always with a veil over his face. You remember that? Moshe, you don't remember? Michael Jackson, he was a singer, right? Anyway, so his kids, he never wanted them to be stuck in the world. So he put a veil over their faces. So the Chasam Sofer apparently wore a veil over his face until he went to yeshiva at three years old. So the first sights he would see outside of his home should be the sights of Torah. Interesting experience. So he comes to yeshiva when he's 3 years old, and he's there and he's learning. And the Rebbe starts teaching them Chumash. Now remember, he's 3 years old, right? And the Rebbe comes to a pasuk and he says that as God made Vayikach Hashem Elokim afar min ha'adama, God came along to fashion Adam HaRishon, and he took dirt from the ground, or as the Rebbe translated, afar min ha'adama, ud fun der ud, or earth from earth. So the Chasam Sofer at 3 years old says, what are you talking about? How could the word afar and the word adama both be ud? I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. And so therefore, he said, that can't be pshat. And the Rebbe turns around and realizes, if a three-year-old has this mindset to realize the difference in nuances in the wording in a pasuk, he must be a special person. And so therefore the Malamed tells this story to the Chasam Sofer's father, to Rav Shmuel. So Rav Shmuel tells the story over to one of the great rabbis in town, whose name was Rav Nassan Adler. We're going to come back to him too, because he plays a huge influence on the Chasam Sofer. And so Rav Nassan Adler says to him, you got a problem. This kid can't sit in a regular yeshiva. He's going too fast. He's got to be able to be raised. Take him home, raise him in Milos and Midos yourself. And so Rav Shmuel agrees, and he takes him into his house. So Rav Shmuel starts to raise the boy, and he's raising his son to be a boy of character and a boy of intelligence. And the boy, at 5 years old, figures out that there's a machlokas as to what bracha should be made on sugar. So the Chasam Sofer, at 5 years old, realizes there's such a problem. If that's the case, he was never going to suck sugar by itself, which is a big problem because, you know, if you're 5 years old and someone gives you a candy and you have to say, imagine, Dr. Langer, some kid says, I'm sorry, I can't have the lollipop because I don't know what bracha to make on it, right? Because there's a machlokas haposkim, right? You'd be pretty shocked and impressed with a five-year-old who figures that out. But take a look. He made that decision. We're not talking about a regular person when we talk about the Chasam Sofer. And this is at 5 years old. And, you know, the standard article rate, he finished a Masechta when he was 7 years old, and he was all impressive. 9 years old. This young man is now recognized. People say, like, hey, take a look at that. So he's 9 years old, and he's giving a drusha in Rav Nassan Adler's Beis Medrash. He gets up, nine-year-old kid, but he knows what he's talking about. And he's giving this tremendous discourse, and all the Talmidei Chachamim in the town are sitting and they're listening. This cute little nine-year-old giving a shiur, and the little kid jumps up and he offers a position, and he says, you know, the Marashach says this, I think he's wrong. And his father gets up in the front of the whole room, picks up his hand and whacks the kid very hard. And Rav Nassan Adler gets up from his spot and he says, what did you do? He says, I am gozer, says Rav Nassan Adler. I command that you take this child out of your house. You are not able to raise the child anymore. And I want to take care of him. I want to raise him myself. because if I leave him to you, you're going to break his creative spirit and he's going to become a great big nothing. And so therefore, Rav Nosson Adler took on this little boy, the Chasam Sofer, and he raises the Chasam Sofer. By the way, the Chasam Sofer makes it his business to stand staunchly behind his Rebbe, Rav Nosson Adler, which is going to be important because Rav Nosson Adler was a little bit of what we call a little bit of a funky character as far as the rest of the town is concerned. He's a little bit more of a Kabbalist. People had a little bit of a trouble with him. He hired an individual to come into his home to teach him how to daven like a Sfaradi, because he decided that the Ashkenazi pronunciation was completely wrong, and he wanted to make sure he hired somebody specific to teach him the Miftah. This is Rav Nosson Adler. Okay, so the Chasam Sofer is doing really well for himself. He's living with Rav Nosson Adler. He's learning by Rav Nosson Adler. He's in the yeshiva. Wherever Rav Nosson Adler sits, there's a little room off to the side so that every time someone comes in to talk to Rav Nosson Adler, the Chasam Sofer is able to go like this and learn from his Rebbe, right? At some point when he was about 15 or 16, he decides to go learn by Rav Tavel Shager in Magenza. And then his parents decided, no, you have to come back home after about a year or two, make him come back to Frankfurt. But, as I mentioned before, Rav Nosson Adler was a little bit of a funky dude in Frankfurt. And some of the people didn't like him so much. And so therefore, they sort of convinced the Rav Nosson Adler that it's probably a good idea for you to get out of town. So Rav Nosson Adler says, okay. And he decides to become a Rav in Moravia. So he leaves Hungary. He's going to Moravia to come to the town of Baskovitz. And there was a whole crowd that was a big, that were very into the Chasam, to Rav Nosson Adler. And they're like, listen, what are you going to do? And so they decided to accompany him, at least as he gets to the city limits. And the Chasam Sofer, who personally felt very attached to his Rebbe, he jumps out in front of the crowd and he says, oh, I want to go live by my Rebbe. I want to go serve him in Baskovitz. And then he goes, and he turns to his Rebbe and he says, did I just make a neder? Because I forgot to say Bli Neder. I want to go serve with you. What do I do? And so he turns to Rav Nosson Adler and he says, did I just take a neder that I have to go live with you? And Rav Nosson Adler goes, yeah, I think you did, right? And so the Chasam Sofer says, okay. And he tries to jump onto the wagon. But of course, there was no room for him on the wagon. So he says, okay. And he starts running after the wagon, right? Here's his Rebbe going off to Moravia. And he's... The Chasam Sofer, Moshe Schreiber, 16, 17 years old, he's going to run along with them. And he runs and runs ahead. Well, at some point, Rav Nosson Adler goes, this is crazy. He's just run like 4 miles, 5 miles, and we can't get past him. He's still there. You know what? Stop the wagon. Make some room. They make some room for Moshe Schreiber, and he goes off to Moravia, to Baskovitz, together with his Rebbe, Rav Nosson Adler. 3 years later, in Baskovitz, Moravia, they get a little bit concerned. Somebody didn't like something that Rav Nosson Adler Paskin went ahead and went to the government in Moravia and said, he's a foreigner, get rid of him. And so Rav Nosson Adler now has to turn around and go back to Germany, and he starts heading back to Frankfurt. Okay, so he went back. But what about Rav Moshe Schreiber? So he stayed along, and he opened the yeshiva, and he marries the local Rav of the town from Prosnitz. Now, it's interesting, the Rav of the town had passed away. Right. And at that point in time, he's in Prosnitz, and here he is. And he decides to marry the daughter of the Rav of Prosnitz. OK, as soon as they get engaged, the Schreiber family hears the following thing. You know, that girl that you thought was a young girl who had never been married before? The daughter of the Rav of Prosnitz? Well, you should just know something. She was married before, right? And you know why? She was married before because she got divorced because she couldn't have children. And so the Schreiber family goes to the Chasam Sofer and they say to him, you got to break the engagement. Chasam Sofer says, I don't make a decision like that without getting a message from my Rebbe, Rav Nosson Adler. So he writes a letter to Rav Nosson Adler and he says, Rebbe, whatever you tell me, break it or not break it, that's what I'm going to do. But you have to worry because there's going to be a wedding date. And so sure enough, what happens? The days are coming. There's no message. Chasam Sofer wakes up and he says, most of us wake up, we go, he didn't answer. What are we going to do? Let's delay the wedding. Not Chasam Sofer. He says, if the Rebbe didn't respond, it must be a simon that I am supposed to go ahead and go ahead with the wedding. And sure enough, he goes ahead and he marries Sarala, the daughter of the Rav of Prussians in Moravia. And so what happens? He gets married. He doesn't break the engagement. And he opens the yeshiva in Prussians. And then he takes on the position as Rav at the same time. And this is the first of many opportunities that we're going to find something unique about the Chasam Sofer. Not only does he serve as a community rabbi, he serves as Rosh Yeshiva. Not only does he serve as Rosh Yeshiva, he serves as community rabbi. And this is going to be yet another big theme that we're going to have to pay attention to, because we see that he twins those dual roles very uniquely, and he sees them as inseparable, that a town cannot exist without having Talmud Torah at a high level with Talmidim, and that Talmidim cannot exist without a town to back him up. And this is how the Chasam Sofer proceeds, and he goes ahead and walks around. And for 7 years, being a Rav in Prusnitz doesn't pay very well. Being a Rosh Yeshiva in Prusnitz certainly doesn't pay well. And so therefore, the Chasam Sofer is being taken care of primarily by Reb Hirsch. Who is Reb Hirsch? Reb Hirsch was Sarala, his wife's brother, his brother-in-law. And so the Chasam Sofer sits and learns all day. And by the way, all day, there are diaries about what it was like to learn with the Chasam Sofer. All day was literally mamish all day. He took a break for 3 hours in the afternoon to put his head on a pillow. But otherwise, his day started before Nates, Tanakh before davening, and then he learned, and then he davened, and then he learned, and then he learned this, and then he answered Shilas, and then he went and put his head on the pillow, and then he got up and he said this year, and then in the afternoon for the Balabat, and he said that year, all the way through his day. It's like really like no time to waste. Well, Herschel loses his money. And now the Chasam Sofer doesn't know about it until his wife says, by the way, I don't have a shaitel, right? I don't have anything to cut my hair with. I have this little piece of burlap. And he says, so what happened to your shaitel? What happened to your tichels? And so she says, I had to sell it in order to get wine for Kiddush. Because that's unacceptable. I have to become a Rav. And so he leaves just the town of Prusnitz, and he goes to Dresnitz, right? And he goes and takes his first real position. And by the way, not too long after he becomes the Rav of Dresnitz, guess who hits it big in the market? Herschel, right? Herschel, the brother-in-law who had lost all his money. So he turns around and his brother-in-law says to him, hey, it sounds like the only reason why God took away my money was to get you to go get a job, right? So that the Jewish world would be able to have a wonderful, terrific Rav. And so after 5 years of living in Dresnitz, the Chasam Sofer says, I'm moving on. I'm going to Mattersdorf. And that's where he became known first as Mattersdorfer Rav. This is probably why in Eretz Yisrael, when you heard of Kiryat Mattersdorf, anyone hear of Kiryat Mattersdorf before? Kiryat Mattersdorf was founded by descendants of the Chasam Sofer, usually quite Hasidish area. Even though Chasam Sofer was not Hasidish, he is identified often with the Hasidish world. Most Hungarians are. Remember, he's in Hungary, Moravia, and then Hungary. Okay. So then Chasam Sofer winds up in Mattersdorf, and he serves as the Rav of the Kehila there in Hungary. And his yeshiva comes along with him. Now his yeshiva starts to spread, and it becomes pretty, pretty large. And in 1807, the yeshiva was only 40 people. But by 1809, it went from 40 to 150. By 1821, that yeshiva is 300 students large, maybe at certain points not too long thereafter, 400 people sitting and learning, all on the shoulders of the local community of Dresnitz, of Mattersdorf. Well, after a while, Mattersdorf can't support a yeshiva of 400, just too much. And so therefore, they started to get a little bit nervous in that situation, right? And so, but the Chasam Sofer said, I don't understand what the problem is. You know, either you support the yeshiva or you don't have the Chasam Sofer. You don't get me as the Rav. And so he says, look, if you can't do it, that's fine. I'll send my resume out to other communities. And the condition of my employment will be that wherever I go, the community has to take on the yeshiva. So one yeshiva, my wife is on the call, one community that says we'll take care of this was the community called Neustadt. My wife has a Rav that she grew up with, Rabbi Neustadt. He's a grandson-in-law of Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, right? So Neustadt was a town in Hungary. And so this town in Neustadt says, we will take your conditions. We just want the Chasam Sofer to be our Rav. and we will take the whole yeshiva on. We'll pay for it. And so Chasam Sofer decides, I'm leaving Matisdorf. I'm going to go to Neustadt. And as he's getting ready to leave, 1801, guess what happens? A huge fire breaks out in the Jewish quarter in Matisdorf. Everything's burning left and right. People start freaking out. And so, thank God, nobody died in that fire, but a good chunk of the community's homes went up in flames. Fire goes from one house to the next house, one house to the next house, until it gets to one house that doesn't burn down. Whose house was that? The Chasam Sofer's. What happened at that moment in time? The Chasam Sofer was the rub of the town. If you needed something like a bank, the one person in the town in Europe people tended to trust was the Rav's. So he's got all of people's valuables all over his house. Plus, he has something more valuable than all of that. He has all his chidushim sitting in that house. So the Chasam Sofer gets, the people start realizing we better do something or the Chasam Sofer's house is going to go up in smoke. And so they start freaking out. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? The local well is 7 miles away. They don't know how they're going to get enough buckets of water from 7 miles away to go put out the fire in front of Chasam Sofer's house. Well, a new boy had come into the yeshiva that's mine, who didn't know about the layout of the town of Matisdorf. And he looks in the Chasam Sofer's backyard and he sees there's a well. Why didn't everyone else see the well? Answer, everyone else knew there was a well, but they also knew the well was dry. So this kid doesn't. He throws a bucket down into the well. The bucket goes, you know, down through the string goes all the way down to the bottom. And guess what they hear? Splash! There's water in the well. So he starts drawing up the water. And he's putting out the fire. And people are going ahead, dousing the fire. And all of a sudden, the Chasam Sofer's house is saved. The fire is brought under control. And people are dumbfounded, don't know what to make out of the story. Chasam Sofer does know what to make out of the story. I can't go to Neustadt. You know, I can't go to Neustadt because the people need me here in Matisdorf now. And he says, I can't. I have to stay here and I have to help raise money for people and help them be able to be taken care of. And so therefore, he realizes that's it. You know what didn't happen during that time? And I say this with trepidation because I hope it doesn't happen over here. Money became scarce. And guess whose salary got cut? And I say this with trepidation in front of all my wonderful balabatim here. People couldn't afford to pay the Chasam Sofer. So the Chasam Sofer couldn't even afford to buy paper. And during that period in time, you know where he wrote his Chidushim? All on the inside, you know, that front page of every Sefer and the back page, which is blank, the Chasam Sofer notes that during that time, his grandson, Rav Shlomo Sofer, the rabbi of Rav Shlomo Sofer says, during this time, his grandfather never slept in a bed, because he wanted to feel the pain of everybody else during that period in time. And also, his father was writing on the beginnings and ends of Sfarim in order for him to be able to find paper. So was the poverty. But it teaches us something about the Chasam Sofer. He believed that if there's a need in the Jewish community, that comes first. In fact, they tell a story about another Rav who was living in a town where there was a money press that was forging money that was found in that town. And they decided, if you find a press, who do you blame? The Jews, right? So they arrested a whole bunch of Jews. And they said, unless your rabbi swears that you guys are not involved, right, then we're going to kill you all. So the guy writes to the Chasam Sofer. The Rav writes to the Chasam Sofer. And he says to the Chasam Sofer, he says, I'm afraid to take an oath. The Gemara says it's better not to take a shvua. Should I be taking such a shvua? Or what should I do? So the Chasam Sofer screams at him, Jews are sitting in jail for weeks and weeks on end, families that have no money, and you're worried about whether an Olam Haba, because you took a Shavua, it may affect you negatively? And he says, I don't understand. In Hashem's eyes, freeing a Jew from a dungeon is more important than the fact that you took a nether, especially where your nether is the truth. And so the guy goes ahead and realizes that the Chasam Sofer. The Chasam Sofer, an Erev Yom Kippur one year, calls a student into his house and he says, there's a certain girl I want you to marry. She's an orphan. She's that age. No one's helping her. I decided you're going to marry her. The student says, the Rebbe says, I'm going to marry her. I'll marry her. Chasam Sofer says, oh, if that's the case, now I'm ready to go into Yom HaDin. I helped somebody. At least something I did this year. I'm ready to go to Yom HaDin. That's the style of the Chasam Sofer. It's not, he's, you know, the certain times we get the impression he was a fanatic, he was crazy. That's nuts to say such a thing about such a Talmud Chacham, and that he didn't have love for the Jewish people. That's off the wall. And it's important for us to understand that. Because there's one thing that if you introduce people to and you say Chasam Sofer, there's one line people will always quote to you. And what's that? It's a play on words. What is the words? Chadash Aser Min HaTorah. People like to point out that the Chasam Sofer was not an innovator. He was not so into the innovation. Why was he not into innovation? He was into innovation, and when it came to halacha, coming up with creativity to explain things or to attach things, take a look. There are 9 volumes of tshuvas of the Chasam Sofer. Clearly, he understood how to apply halacha to modern situations. People all over Europe, and certainly between Hungary and Germany, they were writing to the Chasam Sofer for his opinion. So, what do you mean he was not into newness and uniqueness and creativity? The answer is, there was one aspect of creativity that was blazing on the German-Hungarian border during his lifetime. And what was that issue? The reform. The reform movement was growing at that point in time. It was building up strain, and especially in the German communities, but to a lesser degree in the Hungarian communities, there was a tremendous tension. Right, that was going on, where the Orthodox were quickly getting outnumbered and outplayed by whom? By the larger Reform contingent. And so the Chasam Sofer fought it with all his might. And he was known as one of those individuals who had a very strong position about Reform and anything that smelled Reform. Doesn't mean he didn't like the Reform people. And in fact, if you look, there's an article that appeared in a journal called the Torah Umada Journal, written by, I believe, one of the descendants or the relatives of the Chasam Sofer. His name is Aaron Schreiber, a tremendous recognized scholar. And he argues that in no uncertain terms, certainly early on in the Chasam Sofer's rabbinic career and Rosh Hashiva career, he was very, very cordial towards even the environment of reform and even encouraged the study of secular study. Later in life, things got a lot more strict. Possibly because the winds of reform got stronger and was stealing more kids away. And sometimes the way to handle those things when the people are moving in one direction is to pull back in the other way. Anyway, once Matisdorf started to get itself back on its feet, the Chasam Sofer went back to tending to his yeshiva. Remember when we last left the Chasam Sofer, he was trying to make sure that he would find a community that would feed his yeshiva and be able to support the yeshiva. And so he finds out that there's one major city in Hungary. It's a capital city, Pressburg, right? And he discovers that in Pressburg, the people have enough money to pay and support the yeshiva. Their Rav, Rav Meshulam Igra, had passed away, a tremendous Talmud Chacham, and nobody had been appointed. And then the word came up, what about the Chasam Sofer? Well, the Chasam Sofer, everyone agreed he should be they appointed the Rav of Pressburg, and so they bring the Chasam Sofer in, and he takes the job, right? And the reformers in town start getting nervous and start threatening him before he even gets the job. And so the Chasam Sofer says, you can go ahead and you can push, right? But you need to understand, I'm going to stand back. Later he would say, my enemy set an ambush for my soul until at night I said, he said, my enemy's war is out to get me. But through it all, I stayed in the Beis Medrash. I made sure to have the opportunity to continue in the Beis Medrash to be able to function. And so therefore, he was able to proceed and be able to function, and he was able to continue. And the Rabbi Teitz always likes to tell a very famous story. When the Chasam Sofer first came to Pressburg, the people presented him with a big town book. And they said to him, every Rav who's come into town has introduced a new minhag into town, and whatever you choose today, that will be the minhag of Pressburg. And sure enough, the Chasam Sofer says, okay. He says, yes, so every Rav has always put in a new minhag. So he sits down, and the people are watching, and the Chasam Sofer is writing, and he's writing, and he's writing, and he's writing, and he's writing. And so they asked him, what are you doing? And they look inside. They see the Chasam Sofer just wrote the Aseres HaDibros into the Book of Menhagim. So I asked him, what's this? He says, I figured you guys are so into your Menhagim. I figured if I wrote down the Aseres HaDibros, you probably would keep them better that way. So right, that's, you know, okay, Darko Bakodesh, Rabbi Teitz uses this as a joke, right? But there is a certain understanding that the Chasam Sofer had a certain sense of humor about him. And here he is, he becomes the Rav in Pressburg. He takes over this major town and he stays there for 33 years. And then basically everyone's sending him shilas all day long. The outside community, the lay leadership of the world really gets into him. The lay leadership of the Orthodox Jewish world at the time included a very famous family called the Rothschilds. And Baron Rothschild thinks that Chasam Sofer is a great individual. And he says, you know what I want him to be? As I'm Baron, I want him to turn around and become chief rabbi of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And Chasam Sofer goes, no, thank you. So Baron Rothschild says, I'm offering you the opportunity. You're already recognized that way. Why don't you want to be the chief rabbi? And he says, look, it's great. When I take the job now, I know that the job will be done right. However, once the position of chief rabbi is created, what does that tell you? Long after the person fills the position will be there. Who's going to take the position after me? I can't promise. And so therefore, I don't think the position should be created. And so he fights off Baron Rothschild, and the Chasam Sofer says, I'm okay being the Rav in Pressburg here, and believe you me, people all over the Austro-Hungarian Empire are writing to him anyway. And what's his primary focus in life? Still the yeshiva. Because for him, the two are inseparable. So his wife passes away. No children. Okay? Tough situation. He's all alone, except for the yeshiva. In 1812, word comes to him that there's a letter that comes from Rav Ki Baker, and he says, you know, I heard about you. We've talked a lot in learning. Can you tell me, is there a boy in the yeshiva who might actually be an appropriate shidduch for my daughter? My daughter's husband passed away, and now she'd like to be married. She'd like to take care. So Chasam Sofer writes back and he says, yeah, I think I know somebody, but I don't know if your daughter will be okay with that idea. And he says, well, yeah, how about me? Ki Baker thinks to himself, you know, I don't think this guy understands, you know, this is the great Rav of Posen, Rabbi Ki Baker, and he says, I don't think this Chasam Sofer understands. He thinks I'm something big. I feel bad. I feel I'm cheating him. By saying, oh, he thinks he's going to get a wonderful, terrific Talmud Chacham for a father-in-law, but he's only getting Akiva from Poison. And at the same point in time, Rav Moshe Schreiber is sitting there saying, I hope he takes me, because I think he thinks that I'm a nachschlepper. And you're talking about two of the greatest minds in Europe and into the Torah world of Europe at that time. Until today, these are, you say Rabbi Ki Baker, everyone goes, shh. You mention the Chasam, and they go, oh! Right? These are two great personalities, and everyone's getting excited about the situation. He marries the daughter of Rabbi Ki Baker in 1812, and all of a sudden, Chasam Sofer discovers he's no longer without children. His daughter, his wife, Rabbi Ki Baker's daughter, has 10 kids, 7 daughters, 3 sons, and including the Ksav Sofer, Rabbi Shmuel Binyamin Sofer, the Rav of Krakow, Rabbi Shimon Sofer, and Rabbi Yosef Yuspa Sofer. Each one recognized as a Talmud Chacham of fine import, ultimately Jewish leaders, and of course the daughters marry people of that type as well. And so the Chasam Sofer, who's known as a strong character among his students, he's also recognized as a tati to the students. He's the father that they all want to look up to. In fact, at one point in time, he's outside going out to his rest in the afternoon, and he sees his students walking around with some dirty clothing and shoes that are unpolished. And he looks at the Talmidim and he says, a person who's careful about the way he looks and not about his soul is like a garbage bin covered with roses. However, he says, a person who worries about his soul and not about his appearance is a vase of roses covered in garbage. Anyone who sees the garbage turns around and walks away and is disgusted by the roses. What a fascinating statement. I remember the former rabbi of Atlanta, and Dr. Wenger, you're with us, the former rabbi, Rabbi Emanuel Feldman. I remember Rabbi Emanuel Feldman wrote one of these great essays that shaped me to a certain degree when I was younger, and in yeshiva, it was called Tefillin in a Brown Paper Bag. And the argument that was presented was nobody would dream of leaving a pair of tefillin in a brown paper bag. So too a Talmid Chacham has to be able to be a person who knows how to present his wonderful Torah ideas in a with a clarity, with English, with organization, both in writing and in spoken word. And this, of course, I believe is a build off of that comment of the Chasam Sofer. You have to look in a certain way. If not, you'll be seen as garbage. And of course, the wonderful roses get lost. And that is something that he expected. He held the students to a standard of responsibility. And this becomes the basis of the Chasam Sofer. And he continues his major battle in life. His major battle was to bring Jews closer to the Word of God, not to the Reform, and not to be assimilated away from the Reform. And he's joined by the other Talmidei Chachamim of his time, including his father-in-law, Rabbi Akiva Eiger, and Rabbi Yossi Shaul Natanson of Lemberg, and Rabbi Tzal Rochberg of Prague. But he continued fighting this battle, and the Maskilim tried to fight against him. It remains to debate as to how opposed to secular study he was. But one thing is clear, towards the end of his life, he took a pretty solid, strong right-wing turn. And that's where a lot of our associations with the Chasam Sofer were. It's not the knowledge he was opposed to. It was the way that it was supposed to exist independent of knowledge of Torah. And that's something the Chasam Sofer couldn't understand. It's interesting that the Chasam Sofer is quoted as being one of somebody who had a very strong love of Eretz Yisrael. And he writes very clearly that if you're going to study agriculture and science so that you can work the land and settle the land of Eretz Yisrael, there's no greater use of your time than that. Here's a man who's opposed to secular study, and yet when it comes to settling Eretz Yisrael, it becomes a mitzvah. Not just mutter, a mitzvah. So serious did he take Chibas Eretz Yisrael. And his children also, his children were the ones who made it their business to support Eretz Yisrael. During World War I, there was a huge famine in the land of Israel. Chasam Sofer is long dead. But which country was the one that stepped up first to handle the financing of the Yishuv in World War I? It was the country of Hungary and the Jewish community of Hungary. And why are they stepping up the plate? They step up to the plate for one major reason. And why is that? Because that's the way they were taught. The Sofer family, which becomes the leadership of the Hungarian Judaism, had very strong feelings towards the process of developing an Avata Aretz and a Yeshiva Aretz and a desire, a Chibata Aretz. And this is all part of the Chasam Sofer's legacy. In fact, the Yeshiva ultimately develops where? In Eretz Yisrael, and of course there's Kiryat Matzdorf and all those other markers all over Israel. In fact, there's a whole hechsher in Eretz Yisrael known as Chug Chatam Sofer. You ever see that hechsher? Chug Chatam Sofer? Who's in charge of the Chug Chatam Sofer? Those who follow the Piskei Halacha of the Chasam Sofer, and that environment that's there as well. This all comes out of his Chibat Haaretz. The Chasam Sofer died at the end of Tishrei in the year 1839. It's fascinating. If you go to Hungary now, and I watched a clip from Professor Abramson and then went back to check it out, you can travel on a certain road in the middle of Hungary, and they travel, and you see a rail, like some sort of rail line that was set up, to be able to provide in that situation. And here he is sitting there on the, you get there and you're traveling there. The trolley rail line never actually looked like it ever functioned too well. But in the side of a mountain, you see this really weird obelisk. And then in the ground, you see a bunch of glass, like I think it's 28 or 34 green glass matzevos, right? Individual pieces of green glass that go into the ground. And you try to figure out, what is this? And they tell you, oh, this is the kever of the Chasam Sofer. This is not the kever of the Chasam Sofer. This is 28 or 34 pieces of green glass. What's going on? So if you walk into the side of the mound over there, and you start walking in, you see, and you turn in a certain way, and then turn in a different way, you see, HaMakom HaZeh Kadosh, and in three languages it says, this ground is holy. Be careful, you're in a holy place. And then you walk in to make a turn to the side, and you see 24 or 28 or 34 a kvarim of the sofer family, and on top of each of the kvarim, there is the bottom of that green glass. What happened? In the midst of World War II, the head of the city over there in Pressburg decided that he wanted to build this monorail. And so he decided he's going to just wipe out the Jewish cemetery there. So he goes to the Jews and he tells the Jews, you guys, I'm wiping it out. So the Jews asked for permission to at least go ahead and move the graves. And so they dug up the graves and they started to move them. And then word comes to the guy and he says, whatever you do, you may not move the Chasam Sofer's kever. Why? I told you, the Chasam Sofer's Rebbe was known as a Kabbalist. The stories of the Chasam Sofer with the well and other similar such stories seem to suggest that the Chasam Sofer was somebody whose soul you don't mess with. And so even this terrible guy, this Nazi who ultimately destroys the community of Pressburg in World War II, but he was told, you mess with the Chasam Sofer and I'll haunt you forever. And so rather than destroy the Chasam Sofer's kever, he decides he's going to preserve the kever of the Chasam Sofer and his family and build around it. And that's how that green glass came into place and why the kever of the Chasam Sofer is right there in a mound surrounded by rail lines. P.S. the trolley never ran, right? So all we have left is the green glass of the Chasam Sofer's kever. It's incredible. It's something to see. In fact, there's a whole website dedicated just to this site, the Chasam Sofer's kever. Get bored one day and you're looking for some place to visit in the summer, this is one way of doing a virtual tour. Take a look. It's a fascinating idea. 1831, the famous year. The Chasam Sofer is away on summer break. Where does he go? He goes out to the springs. Very common. The rabbis, some point after Tisha B'Av, they would take a break until Rosh Chodesh Elul, and he's away. And all of a sudden, word comes to him from Galicia. He's there at the summer home, and he hears that there's a terrible pandemic blowing their way through Europe. Would the Chasam Sofer go ahead and declare a fast day because of all the Jews elsewhere in Europe? And so in Igros Uksavim, Volume 1, I think it's the very first tshuva over there, the Chasam Sofer says, I don't think that's a good idea. Why don't I think it's a good idea? He says, because if in Europe they start to hear that we're fasting because of something going on in Galicia, do you know what the king of Pressburg is going to think? He's going to think that we are in it with everybody else. He's going to go ahead and destroy the Jewish community. So I don't think we should declare a fast day, but I do think that we should start saying B'hu Rachum every single day. You know, the Monday and Thursday B'hu Rachum of Tachnun, I think that it should be said every single day. And it should be said out loud. And then, you know, in the middle of Tachlin, when you put your arm down, and right before, after you put your arm down, you pick up and you say, Shomer Yisrael, Shmor She'eris Yisrael. He says, I think every single day they should say the Yehi Ratzons that we say after Kriyas HaTorah. I think during the pandemic they should say it over there. When we ask our Kadosh Baruch Hu to show Rachmanas on us and on the rest of Am Yisrael, that we, and he goes, and all those other things. And then the Shmiras HaSofer, that volume I showed you before, the 200, 300 pages, they record the rest of the Seder HaTfilah that the Chasam Sofer insisted be recited every single day, twice a day. And so this becomes, one of his major contributions. He set up a whole system of prayer as the Talmud of a Kabbalist you'd expect from him to do. He also tells the people that, you know, remember, he's there over the summer. What comes after the summer? Yom Kippur. Now, we know what happened on Yom Kippur in Posen. We talked about that when we talked about Rabbi Kibager. What happened that year in Pressburg? So the Chasam Sofer says, tell the people not to go out to shul on Yom Kippur if it was dangerous for them to do so. And who's going to be the one to determine if it's dangerous or not? So the Chasam Sofer writes in Tshuva that it's up to the Rabbanim who have to go ahead and come up with their answer in consultation with the doctors. Masha Yomru Aleichem Harofim Yasu. What the doctors tell you to do, that's what you should do. Lesson number 2, when you are dealing with emergency issues, you consult with the medical professionals, not the local dentist, not the local shaman. You go after the best in the business. Be'ad hayom hazeh. Now, Chasam Sofer in his drushes also says that he told people during this pandemic, by the way, a pandemic that cost 150 people who got sick in Pressburg at this time and 30 people who died in 1831, an extraordinary number for Pressburg in that short period of time. So he tells the people every day, you don't know what tomorrow is going to bring. So say vidui. And he has everybody saying vidui every day, because who knows if you're going to get a chance to do it. And so therefore, this was yet another one of his takanas. By the way, he had a bunch of other exciting shilas that also came about because of this 1831 situation. So one of the big shilas that came up actually is a funky shilas that comes up every month for us. There's a question. Every month, there is an opportunity. After Rosh Chodesh, we in Elizabeth and in other places, we usually wait until 7 days after Rosh Chodesh to go outside and do what, Dr. Wenger? To say, yes, to go ahead and say Kiddush Levana.
Kiddush Levana, yeah.
Right? In fact, Dr. Wenger, Devorah, you'll remember from your notes that when we go ahead and we say Kiddush Levana, we recite in the Gemara, El Mali Lo Zachu Yisrael, El Alakbo Pnei Avim Shabashamayim, Ham Achas Bachodesh Dayim. We say that if Am Yisrael would have gotten the chance to go ahead and see the face of God, but even about once a month, right, that would be enough. So the people took Kiddush HaChodesh pretty seriously. You know, sometimes it happens that it's the sky, as the old song goes, sometimes where the buffalo roam, the sky is not cloudy all day. But sometimes the buffalo aren't roaming, and it's and the environment, and not only are the people hungry, but they're in Hungary. And then what happens to them in the process is they don't get a chance, and the sky is all cloudy all day. Not only all day, but for a whole week, 2 weeks. Now the 15th day of the month has gone by. Then now it's the 16th night of the month, and the people want to know they didn't get a chance to say Kiddush Levana. And so the Shaila comes to the Chasam Sofer, can we say Kiddush Levana on the 16th? Now normally we say Kiddush Levana is only until the Levana is Bimilua, until it's in its full estate, which is usually the 15th or the 16th of the month. And after the 16th, it starts to get smaller, smaller. So the Shaila comes to the Chasam Sofer, is he allowed or able to go ahead and proceed? And so he says, look, most of the time the answer is no. But as in Shalos and Shubas and Orach Chaim, Simon Kuf Beis, he says, listen, you know what happens if we tell people this month you can't say Kiddush Levana? In our town, where people are superstitious, he says, the people are going to think, uh-oh, and this whole month they're going to be walking around depressed, sleeping in graves, waiting to see what happens. This is the midst of a pandemic, and we have to do things to give people hope and inspiration. And so we pass in that month, that particular month, that they could say Kiddush Levana on the 16th, if but for the purpose of keeping the people's spirits up there. Why? Why would the people have the basis of such a crazy idea? Because Kabbalah's Pnei Ashchina is something that people feel strongly about, and if they were able to feel strongly, they would be able to proceed. He also, in a different tshuva, in Chelek Vav Simen Samach Dalid, he realizes that, and we mentioned this earlier in the week, Wengers, and Dina, right? We mentioned earlier in the week that sometimes if you mention the name of disease or anyone sick, right, it raises certain doubts. And sometimes in Shemaim, it's not such a good thing. So the Shaila was raised. There was a baby that was born during the pandemic. There was a question, should we talk about whether the baby's healthy for a bris, not healthy for the bris? And the Chasam Sofer said, don't talk about it out loud. Don't mention it out loud, because people are going to get the wrong impression, and it's going to be Ma'ore Rachamim, and people are going to get depressed, and it's going to cause all sorts of issues. Don't bring it up. Again, the Chasam Sofer and these two Shailas teaches us an important issue about the pandemic. And what's that? It's very important that during crises that we give people hope and we don't allow them to slip into depression. It's hard enough to be dealing with the physical challenges of the time. To be able to deal with the emotional challenges, that just adds and causes more death. And it managed to affect the way he paskin halacha. It doesn't sound like a guy who's not flexible. In Shailos and Tshuvos Yoredeya Simen Shin Lamed Dalid, he points out that there was a certain rule that came out in 1831. And what was the problem? The problem was that people were walking around with a certain mindset. The king passed an edict that people who died from cholera in that year were not allowed to be interred in the same cemetery, the same Jewish cemetery. They had to be put in the cholera cemetery. People were broken. Whoever heard that you can't have your child or your parent or your spouse buried next to you in the regular cemetery? And so they asked the Chasam Sofer, is that a heter for us later to go ahead and reinter the bones? And the answer was, absolutely. Why is this relevant in the year 2020? We'll go back about 11 weeks ago when the cemeteries and the flights to Israel were both very, very hard to get to. And so what happened? People were concerned, what am I going to do if I have to move my body? If I bury over here in the States, will I one day be able to move that body to Eretz Yisrael? Says the Chasam Sofer, of course, make that something serious. He told the people, the tefillah of the masses makes a big difference. Don't just look for omens and little shtick. He apparently had a kameya, had an amulet that was written by his father-in-law. And he also, in a very famous drusha, that has some silver, beautiful long drushas, he said, you know what else really protects during a pandemic? The Torah of the Bnei Yeshivos. He says, you know, there's a story that the Gemara tells about a fox that was on the shores of the river, and the fish came by, and they saw all the nets, and they were trying to dart one way or another not to be caught by the nets of the fishermen. And the fox leans over to the fish and says, boy, you guys have it hard. Why don't you come up here and sit next to me on the shores of the Yam, on the shores of the river? That way, you won't have to worry about getting caught in the nets of the fishermen. Says the Chasam Sofer, citing that Gemara, he says, closing the yeshivas is like taking fish onto the shore. He says, that's why we say in the Gemara, Ein ben David ba, right? Mashiach doesn't come until people are able to look for a fish for the sick person, and it's not going to be there. Says the Chasam Sofer, what does that mean? He says, I'll tell you. When fish start living on the shore, and people don't realize that kills life. When the fish are not in the water, when Torah is not being learned, so then all of a sudden, there's nothing to keep people healthy. What keeps people healthy is a fresh diet. And that's why we've been so blessed in the current situation, that if we can't sit together in the same place, Torah continues to be learned together on the Zooms and on the chats and in all the other opportunities where we get together to share Divrei Torah, Ki Heim Chayenu, V'Orech Yameinu. These are the things that keep us alive. And finally, the other shtick that he was known for is the fact that he explained to people one of the other ways to handle a pandemic is to go ahead and find a yasom and a yasoma. Get to two people who otherwise are not able to, an orphan and two orphans, and try to marry them off even in a cemetery, right? And this is somehow supposed to be beneficial for to stop an epidemic. We show our chesed. So we talked about tefillah, and we talked about avoda, and we talked about Talmud Torah. The last thing he said was Gemilas Chesed. It also has an ability to handle situations. In fact, in Rimanov, which is one of the towns, they picked up on this aspect of the Chasam Sofer. And they decided in the midst of the pandemic, they found a Yasom and a Yasoma in the cemetery. And they married them off in the cemetery. And the Yasoma, as she was walking to her chuppah in the cemetery, she got very nervous, and it looked like she picked up the very same disease that was affecting everyone else. So the Rav of Rimanov turns to her and says out loud, "Mavirin mevnes mevnei akala, akala, mavirin meis mevnei akala." Which literally is a halachic concept. The two parties are going down the road. One is a funeral procession, and one is a wedding procession. We tell the funeral procession to wait until the wedding procession goes through, because this is the one that's alive. But you can also play on the words, Mavirin Mace, the death that's in the face, Mipnei Akala, which is in the panim of the Kala, Mavirin. And of course, as the story goes, true to the Chasam Sofer's promise, the Kala was immediately changed to her expression, the color came back into her face, and she proceeded to go ahead and get married and do well. Who was the Chasam Sofer? Probably one of the most misunderstood individuals of the 1800s. We get an impression that he was old and backwards. But if you bother to pull out a layer, what we find is an individual who was so full and so colorful in Torah life, a man who loved his people, and he reached out to all of them. Some of them rejected him. Some of them rejected the Torah way of life. This was something that he fought tooth and nail because he wanted everybody to have that wonderful opportunity, that sweetness of Limud HaTorah. He was a Rosh Yeshiva par excellence and believed in the power of Yeshiva. He was a person who believed that his life was intertwined with the life of his students, within the life of his townspeople. And he was an individual who, when the entire Jewish world was reeling, the world was reeling from the pandemic, told us Tshuva, Utfila, Utstaka, knowing which way to proceed, Ma'avira Nisroa HaGzira, and instituted principles that you and I continue to benefit from. Ad Hayom Hazeh, may his neshama be a blessing for us, and may we continue to study his Torah, not only during pandemics, but especially at times, and derive inspiration from him as well. I thank you all very much. Bezras Hashem will continue next week. Have a great Shabbos.
Shabbat Shalom. Laila Tov.
Thank you.